It's time for the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel Podcast.
We've got lots and lots of things to talk about and to do today.
Covering the territories from the 1940s to the 1990s.
It's the best thing going today.
Interviewing wrestlers, referees, authors, and other media personalities that have made the sport of professional wrestling great.
The cream, yeah. The cream of the crop.
And now, here's your host, Tony Richards.
Hey there, everybody. This is Tony Richards, and I want to welcome you to our Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel podcast. On our show, we're tracking and documenting the history of pro wrestling from its beginnings through 1990, with special emphasis on the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s pre-video era. We're profiling personalities by having the authors who've studied their lives and written their stories. We're studying and revisiting territories and the booking offices that control them, historic towns where the history of pro wrestling is so deep, and the legendary buildings where the fans came to see their favorite stars and storylines play out virtually every single week. We're covering all four of these dimensions of the sport of pro wrestling, and I'm so appreciative you've decided to allocate some of your time to go on this journey with us through this show. If you like what we're doing, you might want to think about visiting my Substack channel by searching for Tony Richards 4, and there you can subscribe to my daily wrestling history newsletter, where you'll find birthdays of wrestlers past and present, an RIP salute daily to those in the business who we want to honor that have passed on, an event on that day in pro wrestling history, and much, much more. You also have an archive of this podcast and special updates on my Dory Funk Sr. book. All of that is provided for free. But I do have a special vault of writings for paid subscribers. And by subscribing to that, that helps support me and my research and the work to do all of this for you. You'll find it all on my Substack channel, substack.com. Search for Tony Richards 4 and the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel. You can also follow me on X at Tony Richards 4 or join our Facebook group, Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel. Okay, with all that out there, let's go to today's show and today's guest. We're joined by a man who knows a lot about wrestling, specifically Southern wrestling, and he's written a ton of books, and he is the owner and publisher at Crowbar Press. I'm talking about Scott Teal. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tony. It's good to be here.
Hey, man. I'm glad for you to be here, and you've got a bunch of books coming out, but one of the most recent ones that I absolutely love is the second book on Frankie Kane.
Yes.
And this is the book called Raising Kane, and this one is From the Inferno to the Great Mephisto. And just before we get into this one, you had another book you released about 2 or 3 years ago that was the first part of the story, right? Tell everybody a little bit about that book first.
Right. The first book begins with Frankie as a child, and how he pretty much grew up on the streets of Columbus, Ohio. He had a mother and a family, but he pretty much grew up as an orphan on the streets. And he had to fight, he had to fight every day, just steal food just to be able to eat, and fighting on the street. There's amazing stories in the book about how they found places to sleep, how they earned money. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. If you want to know how wrestling evolved, right, from the carnival, yes, and at show days and all that, it, yes, kind of got a little bit of that in the Jody Hamilton book too, about the, yes, about the assassin. And I just find that stuff fascinating, how the business continued to change and evolve.
Yes, Frankie was involved with wrestling real, real early because he met some of the wrestlers, and he was always fascinated by the business. And so he'd hang around the wrestling office there in Columbus, Ohio, wait for the wrestlers to come out. And he didn't, when he was real little, he didn't say a whole lot to them. He didn't, he just sort of kept his distance, but he was there. And then he met Tretch Phillips, and they started this club called the Toehold Club, and they built a makeshift ring in there. And it's really interesting how he came along in the wrestling business. Then he ended up wrestling in the carnivals. He ended up boxing, and that's to me is the most incredible part of his story, because he was going around putting boxers over so that they could have wins, because that's how boxes were rated. You know, this guy's got 52 wins and three losses. And well, Frankie would go around and put those guys over. But what they didn't tell the guy he was fighting, they didn't tell the guy he was fighting that Frankie was only working. Frankie wasn't trying to beat him. Frankie wasn't trying to kill him. So Frankie not only had to make these guys look good, but he had to keep himself from getting killed because the guy he was fighting was after it for real.
Yeah,
that, that takes a real fighter.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's a little hard to wrap your mind around. One guy's working and one guy's shooting, you know. And
yes.
So I could see where, I remember something Ted DiBiase said one time. He said somebody asked him how he was going to work with Hogan, and he said, "Well, if Andre the Giant can get sympathy from a baby from a heel, I can work with Hogan."
You know, That's right.
And so talented workers find a way.
That's right. And Frankie was talented.
You bet.
It was a natural for him. You know, he talks all the time about how he was a little guy and the guys looked down on him because he was small. But man, you could be small if you knew how to work and you could play the psychology on the people, you didn't have any problem. And Frankie didn't, no matter what he did, when he was under the masks as one of the Infernos, when he was simply Frankie Kane in the early days, he got over real big. And of course, then later on, when he got into the character of the Great Mephisto, people believed it.
I loved the book from the very beginning because I opened up the front and there's his daughter writing the foreword, and she says she comes home one day and he's working on his new gimmick.
Yes.
And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is fascinating, you know, because so many of the guys hid all that from their kids.
Yes. Yes. Well, and she may just come in, not him not knowing it, but she said, she didn't even recognize who it was because it was this new character he was developing. She's like, who is that? It doesn't even sound like, you know, if she had any idea Frankie was in the house, she didn't think it was him because it didn't sound like him.
But what she was saying too, and was they traveled with him a lot. I mean, he didn't really try to keep that separate. Like he kept his family with him on the road, and I admire that about him.
Yes, a lot of wrestlers. I don't know. I shouldn't say a lot. Some did, some didn't, because it was expensive when they weren't making. You know, they didn't make a killing back in those days. And the guys, they not only had to, if they did have a home somewhere, say in Savannah, Georgia, well, they had to pay for send money to their wife to take care of the house, the food, everything in Savannah. But then they have the motel costs on the road or a home on the road. So, you know, it was expensive.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, traveling was, you know, in those days for sure. Always is, still is today.
Yes.
He had a very interesting relationship. I mean, he worked for just about every office you can think of, but he had a really interesting relationship with Roy and Nick, and he had the strongest relationship was with Roy and a little bit of a contentious, I guess, relationship with Nick.
Yeah. He some reason Roy liked Frankie, and I think it was just because Frankie was a good worker and he knew what it took to get the people riled up, to get the people excited, to draw money. And Frankie, of course, started as just simply as Frankie Kane without the mask or anything when he worked for Roy. And yes, he had some confrontations with Nick. Nick had his own problems as far as getting along with people. You know, he wasn't always the easiest person to get along with. He liked things done his way. And I never had a problem with him. Never. He treated me like gold.
Yeah.
I can't say anything about that. But as far as Frankie goes, Frankie knew what he wanted to do. And Nick just didn't always see it his way.
You know, back in another lifetime, I ran a broadcasting group. My office was in Cape Girardeau. We were a very large, independently owned group, and we had a group of stations in St. Louis. And Michael St. John worked for me. He ran St. Louis for me. And he always said that, too. He always said he got along with Nick really, really well, and he treated him well. And that's what I tell people all the time. I say, you know, not everybody thinks Nick was, you know, there are some guys who think a lot of him, you know.
Right.
These narratives get going, you know. And I'll throw this one at you, too. Back when I was a fan, I didn't think George was that bad. I mean, when I was watching George and, you know, as a wrestler, I mean, now the narrative is, well, the worst wrestler that's ever been on the planet is George Gulas. I'm like, well, he might not have been that great, but as a fan, I didn't think he was that bad. I watched him and cheered for him, you know.
Right. As the fans didn't, they weren't smart to the business.
Right.
You know, they saw him and they believed what they saw. You know, when he was with Bobby, they drew a lot, the good bit of money with, you know, as the jet set.
Yeah.
They did really well. A lot of the rap that George gets is because he was the Knicks' son. And anytime you're the son of the promoter, you're going to get it. I'll guarantee you, the Von Erichs, I don't care who you are, somebody was going to be making some kind of comments about they're the promoter's son, so they put him over all the time. And that goes for anybody's son in the business.
Yeah, and that might be a little bit of me trying to put some puzzle pieces together, but I think maybe in reading the book, I think one of the reasons that Roy maybe liked Frankie was that Frankie talked about how when Nick needed to get some towns going, he'd send Frankie, right? And yes, he'd go and he'd get the town going and get the tickets going and do promotion and get. And I think that maybe reminded Roy of his younger days.
Oh, yes.
Of going into towns and pioneering them and getting them going and this, that, and the other. And he saw those things in Frankie. I kind of think maybe that was one of the reasons he liked him. What do you think?
I believe that. Absolutely. Frankie wasn't just a wrestler. In fact, Frankie probably doesn't get the due that, you know, the credit he deserves. If he had been in the right place at the right time, he could have started a territory somewhere and would have done great, because he did a lot of booking. And as you read in the book, and it's proven, the towns he drew in Bowling Green, he wrestled Mac York. He wrestled Mac. How many times did I have in that book? And just in one town, like 12 times, you know, 4 or 5 weeks in a row. You don't take a guy like Mac York. And most people in the 70s thought Mac York was just a young job guy, sort of. But Mac had some talent, and Nick and Frankie took him. Same with Pedro Zapata, Oki Shekina. Frankie and Oki made a lot of money in Bowling Green in Alabama. Frankie knew what to do to draw money. And I think, well, it's like you say, Roy saw that in Frankie and sort of, it felt like there were some kind of, they had something in common, you know, that's what they like to do.
Yeah. And he might have even just looked at him and taking all that kind of in consideration, he probably just said, I like that boy. But it was probably based in some of those same things he did when he was younger.
Yes, that's right.
I mean,
and Frankie, when he'd go into territories, he gave a lot of his ideas to the promoters or to the bookers. A lot of what they did came out of his mind. So, you know, yeah, the Infernos drew a lot of money, and people give Leo Garibaldi credit or Gunkel or whoever, Eddie Graham. But Frankie's the one that came up with a lot of ideas. He was in the ring, too. He knew what finishes to use. He wasn't out there just trying to get heat by hitting, using his fists or kicking somebody in the head with the boot. He knew what it took, you know, to build up that heat before he even did that.
Yeah, and probably in a subtle way. I love that subtlety that heels used to have, where it wasn't so obvious, but you still knew it and it still bothered you that they did it.
Right.
I was on somebody's show the other day, and they were asking me what the difference was in the 70s versus, they didn't say today, but it was later on. And I said, well, I think the biggest thing was that in the 80s, we got to the place where, particularly when Crockett expanded, they started booking territories. They started booking the same match in multiple towns.
Mm-hmm.
In the 70s, we were still in a period where you were booking towns, and you were booking returns in those weekly towns. And that's what we're talking about Frankie being so good at. Like Bowling Green, he had a whole 3 months worth of program laid out just for Bowling Green.
Right.
And the television, you had a little part of it that maybe the local interview segment or something like that, but it might just be one little thing that pertained to Bowling Green, but it would carry you if you knew how to do it locally in the town.
Yes.
And that's a lost art.
Right. Well, you mentioned Crockett, and when all this sort of when everything changed, even into the 80s with Crockett, he had a believable product. Vince got more into the cartoon stuff, and they didn't make any pretense of being, I don't want to use the word fake, but I hate to use the word fake, but you know, they didn't hide it. They didn't mind if the heel and the baby face were seen together talking, or the janitors walking in the dressing rooms and they're all sitting there talking. They didn't care. Back in the 70s and even the early 80s, we did everything we could to protect the business. We didn't explain anything to anybody. I mean, I never smartened my wife up until I think we were married. I think we were married a couple of years before I just told her anything. She never asked me. She didn't care, you know, but at the same time, I never smartened her up, never told her anything about the business.
I think probably why I picked them was a personal example. In 1986, I went to four Great American Bashes. And the first one I went to was the one in Memphis that only drew 1,400 people, and I was one of them.
Oh, wow.
And Tully Blanchard and Ronnie Garvin had a taped fist match. And Tully had his robe on, and he charged Ronnie Garvin, and Ronnie Garvin backdropped him. He got up, and Ronnie hit him with his taped fist. I went to Charlotte. He did it again. And I'm like, he can't be that dumb to do that again. So
Right.
it was the same match. It was the same match in Charlotte that I saw in Memphis. I went
Yeah.
to another one like 2 weeks later. It was the same match. And so they were booking it around the bash loop, you know, instead of doing something for Charlotte that would run every Monday night for 10 weeks, they were booking the same match around the
Around the
horn.
horn. Yeah. You know what though? Even in the 70s, they booked the same matches. I mean, a lot of people say that Nick would have a title match in Nashville, and then the next week they changed the title again in Birmingham, the same two guys. But the Birmingham, like, let's say, for instance, Don Green drops the Southern Heavyweight title to somebody in Nashville. Well, people say, well, then the next week in Birmingham, he'd do the same thing. Don Green would still be the champion. They didn't do that in the 70s. But at the same time, they did have the same type of matches. Like you might have Don Green against somebody in a taped fist match. But the people back then had no idea what was going on in the other towns. By the time it was what you're talking about with the Great American Bash, it's all over TV. People knew that they were having it in Charlotte. They knew they were having it in Winston-Salem. They knew they're having all Atlanta, all these different places. But back in the day when I was in the business, most of the people, and there's fans that did knew they read the magazine, so they knew there was matches in Nashville, and they may even have found a out of town newspaper. But at the same time, I'd say 90%, maybe even higher, of the fans did not even realize they wrestled every single week in Nashville. When I was a kid, and not a kid, but a teenager in Florida, when I first discovered wrestling, I watched it on TV for a solid year from Tampa. And I thought, that's so good. I can't believe this. Well, then I don't remember where we went, but somehow I know what it was. I turned the channel to where I was getting a station from Fort Myers, and it was so bad because I used an outdoor antenna that it was like ghost images. You could barely see it, but I could hear him talking. And he all of a sudden, the Gordon Solie says, "We'll see you this Tuesday night in Fort Myers." And I thought, well, isn't that something? I said, not only do they have wrestling in Tampa every week, but they have wrestling in Fort Myers every week. And it never dawned on me that they had wrestling in Jacksonville, Orlando, Miami, all these different towns. I had no idea. Once I learned that, though, I started searching. I'd go to these this newsstand down in Sarasota. They had all the out-of-town newspapers. So I started looking up to see who was wrestling. Sure enough, they had a lot of the same matches. It might be Jack Briscoe against Paul Jones in a Florida title match, and they were the same match in every town. But because we didn't have the internet, people had no idea what was going on, in the town outside of where they were.
And some guys like Frankie, Dory Funk Jr. and Jack Briscoe is the premier match of the 70s, and
Yes.
I mean, they must have had 20 different finishes,
Oh, yeah.
and different. I mean, they'd go to a time limit draw and do that match differently at the draw five different ways,
Yeah.
and they were good at that. And Frankie Kane was good at that, while other guys did their match, you know.
I was
So
going to
it.
say that when you mentioned that about Ronnie and Tully having their match, and it was the same match. They may have had Jack Briscoe and Funk may have had the same. It may have been a world title match in every single one of those cities. But at the same time, Exactly what you say is true. They did not do the same match. For one thing, they didn't script any of it out. Where
Right.
nowadays everything's scripted, so it's all cookie cutter stuff. Back then, they called everything in the ring. The only thing that may be the same or be planned is what either they came up with for a finish, or the promoter said, "I want you to do this for a finish, so next week we can come back with you two again, and against each other in this other kind of a match." But back then, they didn't plan anything.
Right.
Everything was called right there in the ring. So even if a fan on Tuesday night was in Tampa and they saw Briscoe wrestle Funk, and like you said, they go to Miami on Wednesday night, it wasn't the same match. So it really didn't smarten them up, because they thought, well, they're having two matches against each other.
Well, Jerry Briscoe told me that when he wrestled Dory in for Thanksgiving, like in 72 or 73, one of those years, I can't remember which, but Mr. Crockett told him he wanted him to go Broadway, and Jerry said, "I went and found Dory and said, I've never done that before. Like I've never gone a whole hour with anybody before." And Dory goes, "Don't worry about it. We got it, kid. You know." And he said he led him through the whole thing, and it was great. I mean, they had a great match, you know. And
That was probably Charlotte Park Center, I believe.
I think so. But it was that's a lost art.
Oh, yeah, they got to have everything given to them these days, and that's because of the nature of the way the business is. It's not that they couldn't do it. It's just because that Vince wants it a certain way, or whoever wants it a certain way. And so they give them the script, or could say, you do this. And the worst example of all this that I can come up with, it goes all the way up into Joel Goodhart's time with in Philadelphia when he was pr promoting it. We just released his book. And in his book, he said he would go into dressing rooms, and not only would they have the wrestlers' names on the wall, so and so against so and so, but they'd have an X by the person they wanted to win. And then the wrestlers would be in the dressing room talking about, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. They didn't do any of that back in the day. I mean, a lot of times when I was there, the Huntsville was different because the dressing room, you went in one door and there was a side for the heels, side for the baby faces, but the fans couldn't see because we could walk back and forth. So the baby face, yeah, they could go talk to the heel about their match. But a lot of dressing rooms like Nashville, heels were on one side, baby faces were on another. They didn't even see each other until they got in the ring. They knew enough about the business. They were smart enough that they could get in the ring and work that whole match without planning anything ahead of time.
And the business environment for the business has changed too, where the time
Absolutely.
we're talking about was a house show business,
Yes.
and television was supporting the house show business. And now
Right.
it's a television product that sometimes has a house show, you know. So
A house show is almost a byproduct of the television show.
the house show is like the background for the television show. I mean, it's the live audience for the event or whatever. You know, but things change, you know, but I still love our era. You know, I mean, that's one of the reasons I love this book so much, is it transports me back to a different time. And
Yes, it
that's
does.
one of my favorite things to do, is to go back to that. What was your, you must, you spent hours with Frankie Kane doing this, right? Between the two books. And
Probably close to a We probably did close to not even the time we just spent together as friends, but we probably spent 100 hours doing interview work.
Oh, wow.
Me asking a million questions.
How much did not make the book?
I left out a lot of sex stuff.
Yeah.
Not him so much as stories he told about the
Stories.
guys, I
Right.
mean, there's some crazy stories, and you probably heard a lot of them, but I left out a lot of that.
Yeah.
There's not a whole lot other than maybe stories here and there about different guys that I just didn't put in there for one reason or
Well,
another.
the only reason I asked that question is I was just in the back of my mind wondering if there would be a third book. That's why I was asking, you know.
Now, if anything, we'll have in my wrestling archive project books where I do it, where it those started out with supposedly taking my old interviews from my Whatever Happened To magazine and reprinting them, but also adding two or three new brand new interviews to the books. If anything, the next whatever wrestling archive project book that I do, I'll have some more stuff with Frankie. In fact, when I was down there a couple months ago, we sat around talking every day, and he'd tell these stories he had never told me before, and we had talked for, I said, 100 hours at least. Right. And he told me so many stories, and I don't make notes. I just put down, like, he told a story about Frank Townsend, who died. He fell out of a boat and drowned. Frank Townsend was a wrestler. And I keep a little piece of paper with me, and I just wrote down, Frank Townsend falls out of boat. That way I can call Frankie and I can say, tell me the story about Frank Townsend falling out of the boat.
Yeah.
You know, and then I can record it. So I bet I had 30 references to stories he told while I was down there that he had never told me before.
Oh, man.
So we won't have a whole book. If I really pushed him, we probably could, but there's going to be a lot. I'll still have a lot to share in the future.
Well, I just want people to know, if you haven't bought this book, first of all, you need to, but I'm going to tell you ahead of time that here's how I felt when I read it, because it's not written the way a lot of books are written. It's written like you guys are sitting and having a conversation, right? And yeah. I when I read it, it's my one of my favorite things is I felt like you guys were sitting and having coffee, and I just got to sit and listen.
I love it.
And that's how I felt, and I'm like, and that's why I enjoyed it so much.
Thank you. That's what I look for. That's what, you know, I told somebody, not, and I've quit writing books where I do interviews with these guys, like Ole Anderson, JJ. You know, I've taken all the stuff that we've talked about, the interview work, and I rework it all, put everything in chronological order, and then write it as if they wrote it. I'm through with that, because I have said this ever since I started my Whatever Happened magazine back in 1992. When you read those interviews, you feel like you're sitting across the kitchen table from the guy that's telling his story, rather than reading a book like he wrote it and he's writing out his stories and telling you what happened. No, you feel like you're sitting there with him. And I appreciate you saying that, because that's what I look for. I want people to feel that. You feel like you're sitting right there. It's like Killer Carl Cox. Somebody wrote me the same thing. They said they felt like they're sitting across the table from him, and he's sitting there telling them his story personally. It just comes out so much more natural.
It added exponential enjoyment of my reading the book. So I appreciate you, I don't know, I guess taking a chance and going out and doing that differently, right? Because you don't know how it's going to come across to people, but that's how it came across to me. And I think people will enjoy it for that reason.
The reason I did that, and I sort of had a little bit of a heads up as far as whether people would like it or not, is when I did my Whatever Happened To magazines, people loved them, because it was in an interview style rather than writing a story about somebody. The words are coming right out of their mouth. So I knew it would work. It's just that when I first started doing books with Ole Anderson, I thought, well, we're writing Ole's book. I need to write it like a book, you know, as if he sat down and wrote it. Mm-hmm. But why go to all that trouble? Why try and reword everything? Present it like they talk, like they speak, you know, exactly what the way they tell me. Now, I do take a lot of liberties. I move stuff all around. I mean, it's like a big jigsaw puzzle when I get through interviewing somebody. I move it all around, get it so it all flows chronologically, and I change words. But I try and present it in a way so that it sounds like it would, you know, if you were sitting there and he was telling you, like, you wouldn't want Tony Atlas using these big, big words, you know, as you go through his book. You know, even when I wrote his book, his is not interview format, but even when I wrote the book, I didn't change a lot of stuff, you know, as far as making him sound like he's some erudite scholar or something, because Tony's not. Right. You know, he doesn't read. He can probably read some now, but he didn't grow up being able to read. So I want them to sound like these guys rather than something somebody else wrote about them.
Yeah, well, I thought it was great. I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed having coffee with you guys.
I love it.
So just kind of to wrap up here, what's the one thing you came away with? I mean, you obviously have a very strong and trusting relationship with Frankie, so you got to know him very, very well. And I always thought he should have gotten more opportunities to book than he got. He should have been more involved as the business prospered more. He would have been fantastic for somebody.
Absolutely.
What was your big takeaway from having the relationship with Frankie Kane?
The one thing I find about Frankie, and this is probably a rarity in the wrestling business, Frankie is as genuine as a person could possibly be. You know, Frankie told, he doesn't shoot bull to you, try and make himself sound more important than he was. And I'll tell you how I do that. I have people say, "How do you know that these stories these guys tell you are true?" I say, "Well, I got one way of finding out, especially these stories that are, you know, sort of out there, sort of almost outlandish, just like that's just almost unbelievable. You know, like Don Fargo's book. I don't know if you've read it, but some of the stories he wrote, people go, 'Are you kidding me? That would couldn't that there's no way that would have happened.' Well, I'll guarantee you, knowing Don Fargo, every one of those stories happened. Well, what I do when I have a story that's just so crazy, it's like almost unbelievable, I wait 2, 3 months and I'll call. I say, 'Well, tell me a little bit about this.' And I ask him about this story. I don't ask about the whole story, but I just ask him about the situation. If they te Most of the time, if it's true, they'll tell me exactly the same way. But if not, it's going to come out different, or they're going to have some facts different. That's a way, the best way you can do to find out whether somebody's telling, you know, giving you the exact way a story happened rather than just making stuff up. Because you make something up on the spot with when you're talking to somebody, you're not going to remember that years later or
Or
months later.
weeks later, it's gonna be
Yes, right.
different, you
And
know.
the older I get, it's days later.
Well, it's a fabulous book. I appreciate you doing it. I appreciate everybody out there. You know, when I think back to 30 years ago or 25 years ago, I mean, we maybe had four or five books out there. And
Right.
we got a lot of different guys that are trying to document this history. And I appreciate the efforts of everybody, because a lot of this is just going to be lost if we don't. And
Right.
you have been a leader of that for all of this time, and one of the pioneers of recording this stuff. And I appreciate you continuing on and continuing to do it. You're going to have, what, five or six books this year?
Oh yeah. I just released three, and I've got five I'm working on right now. I've got Tim Dill's book. I've got to get that done. Bless his heart. He's been so good. We did the first volume on the Knoxville and the first volume on the Tennessee Athletic Commission. And I need to get down and finish the second volume of both of those books. Chris Knight's, we did the first volume of Amarillo. I need to get started on that second volume, get those done. And I've got at least 9, 10 books of my own. St. Louis history. The first two volumes of St. Louis are 200 pages each, and they go from like 1876 to 1932. And you're talking about you got 1933 to 1986 or 85, I guess, when Sam retired. So it's going to be a huge set, but I've got a lot to do, and I'm sort of backing out right now. I'm probably going to be slowing down on the number of wrestling books, especially the ones right, I'm probably not gonna write any with other people. If I write anything, it'd be my own stuff.
I'm writing a book on Dory Funk Sr. right now, and I've told Chris a bunch of times, and I'll tell you, I so appreciate that book because it helped me in my research quite a bit.
Good,
Especially
good.
in the early, I mean, you guys go all the way back to 1909 or 1910 or something like
Something
that.
like that. Yeah, I can't remember the year.
Which helped me a great deal just understanding the history. Just a fabulous book, and I'll be so glad when you get the other one done.
Books like that, I mean, who knew there was a guy named Cal Farley that pioneered wrestling in Amarillo, you know? And then a guy named Dutch Mantell. The only Dutch Mantell people know now is the guy, the modern Dutch Mantell, who actually he was working for Nick when I was working for Nick. But people, when you mention Dutch Mantell, that's what they think of. They don't realize that he was a big name promoter in Amarillo back in those days. And he had Doc Sarpolis, and then he had Dory Funk Sr., and then the Funk Front Brothers.
I've got a story in my book that I'm writing about Dutch. He actually had a match in Evansville, Indiana. This is where like people's lives intersect, right? He had a match in Evansville, Indiana in 1926 with Billy Tom. Billy Tom recruited Dory Funk Sr. to University of Indiana. And so that's just an interesting connection there between
Right.
two different people that have a sort of an Amarillo tie.
Was Billy Tom the coach there then?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
In
Wow. See, I don't
Indiana.
even remember that.
Yeah, he was the coach at Indiana University. He recruited Dory to come wrestle there. Of course, Dory went to school in Hammond, Indiana, and was an all-state wrestler for 3 years, and went to Indiana for his freshman year, and coached Billy Tom, and Coach Tom, and had a match with Dutch Mantell in the 20s.
Wow, that's
And
not cool.
yeah, which is kind of interesting to me because I'd been to so many Tennessee matches in Evansville over the years, you know.
Right, that's right. That's an interesting connection, Billy Tom from Indiana and the Amarillo with Dutch Mantell, and then here comes Dory Funk Sr. out of Indiana. That's
And
pretty cool.
then on the subject of never really quite knowing everything and then finding out things you didn't know, when Steve Johnson's book came out about Londos, Dutch Mantell had so much to do with his career, and
Right.
I didn't know that.
Yep.
So
Yep.
there's a lot out there that you don't know, you know.
Oh, there's so much. There's a lot we don't know, and there's a lot we won't know. There's just so much because of the business being so protective and secretive. There's a lot of stuff just was never put down. And I wish I had been able, of course, back in the 60s, 70s, even or early 70s, I'd have never sat down with a guy and picked his brain about his the business like I did starting in 1992. Even then, the guys were open with me because I was friends with most, with them, and so they and I traveled down the road, so they were open. But even if I had said in the 1980s, let's do an interview and write your story and tell everything that really happened in the back behind the skirt, everybody was so secretive. Nobody would have wanted to do that. And it wasn't until the 90s that people finally said, yeah, let's do it. The business has changed. Vince was exposing everything. So why not go ahead and tell the story? But it's a shame we've lost so much of that history because of that. The guys like Jack Pfeffer, man, I would have loved to have sat down with Jack Pfeffer and picked his brain. Thankfully, we have people like Frankie Kane who remembers a lot of the stories about Pfeffer, like he told. Don Fargo tells a lot of stories about Jack Pfeffer in his book.
Now,
But other than that, we've lost it.
did I read somewhere or hear somewhere or something that Jackie Fargo never quite got comfortable talking about the business?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I talked to Jackie and he did an interview with me. In fact, it was in one of my Wrestling Archive Project books. But we didn't go real in depth. He was open, but he wasn't as open as most of the guys that finally decided to tell their story. Jackie just almost to the end just refused to really open up and not kayfabe, his career. I guess if I'd really pushed him, he probably would have.
Well, what I'd really like to do is I'd like for you to come back and talk about your other books as they come out.
Anytime. I'd love to.
I'd
I
appreciate
love talking about the business.
I'd appreciate it. You're doing some great work, and we need to let everybody know about it. So,
Thank you, Tony. I appreciate that a
you
whole
best.
bunch. Appreciate
You
what
bet.
you're doing. What you're doing is helping keep the business alive, too.
Thank you, Scott Teal, everybody from Crowbar Press. Well, I hope you enjoyed sitting in on our visit today, taking a trip back in the pro wrestling time tunnel. Hey, visit my Substack channel at Tony Richards 4. Subscribing to my newsletter helps support the work I do to preserve pro wrestling history. Plus, you get it in your email inbox every single morning, and you never miss an issue of the newsletter or a podcast if you have a free subscription. If you have a paid subscription, that supports my work even more, and you'll get special stuff in the vault. Updates on my Dory Funk Sr. book, which is coming along really, really nicely. I'm close to the end of the research phase and about to start the writing phase later on this fall. I appreciate your investment of time in our show today, and I hope you like and subscribe our podcast and our newsletter. And until next time, bye-bye, everybody.
Thanks for tuning in to the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel Podcast. Tune in for another great episode next week, interviewing wrestlers, referees, and media personalities that have made the sport of professional wrestling great. Be sure to follow us on Facebook at Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel. We'll release a new episode soon. Don't you dare miss it.